Well, all work and no play makes for a dull life, so the saying goes. And so we play. And how we play. Who better to ask than Nicholas Ricketts? He is the curator of the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, and has been in that role since 1998. He's a researcher himself into the history and present of paper artifacts and board games, and served for a time as president of the Ephemera Society of America. The museum holds exhibits ranging from a pinball playfield to a video game hall of fame. But it's not all big flash numbers. The museum serves as a record and a future of the way we play from cradle to grave. That includes wonderful things like jigsaw puzzles and Cluedo. Nicholas is with us from Sunday evening in upstate New York. And welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Have you got the best job in America?
I think a lot of people think I do.
You're not so sure. Tell us a little more. Tell us a little more about the collections that are at the museum.
Well, the collections are mainly considered the largest collection, probably the largest or most comprehensive, we like to say, collection of toys, dolls, games, table games that are under my care, but also arcade games and video games. Video games and the hardware to play them on.
I know it's not your specialty, but let's work backwards. What are some of the classic video games in the museum? Are we going back to Tetris and even further?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And if it's a real classic, then it probably was already inducted into the World Video Game Hall of Fame. We have two halls of fame. I should go backwards and say the Museum of Play didn't really start out that way, but through a number of studies, we determined that there was a real need for a museum like this. And we were a standard history museum at first. And then we had some interactive activities for really young children. There was a sort of a classroom space that was set up like your grandmother's attic. And it was the most popular exhibit. So going along on that, we determined that essentially a family museum based around the concept of play had really never been done before with such massive collections. And we've been building them up ever since we sort of rearranged our mission to reflect the concept of play.
I want to come back to this extraordinary history and how it began with Margaret Strong and her collections. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping just to sort of build a visual first for the listener. So the two halls of fame, and how comprehensive mm-hmm. are they with some of what would be the most recognised games, I don't know, of the last decades, if we're talking video and arcade games, probably the last few decades?
Well, you said Tetris. That's definitely in the Video Game Hall of Fame. Any game that was popular or innovative in some way was a really important teaching game. I'm thinking of Westward Expansion Oregon Trail game. Really, this is not my specialty, but everybody plays these games. In fact, the most recent inductees in the World Video Game Hall of Fame is already inducted for the year 2021. It was the Microsoft Flight Simulator, the StarCraft game, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, and Animal Crossing. So these are really relatively contemporary games, although Carmen Sandiego has been around for a long time.
Are some of them hard to locate? We'll come to your specialty in a moment, the board games, but are some of these games hard to locate in that they're not necessarily digital by any means and probably getting dated, a few of them, and probably people love having them in their collections? How hard to get some of them?
Well, it's a good question. More and more people recognize us, and sometimes collectors are looking to divest their collection, and that is usually a good thing for us because they have formed their collection around a certain subject, which they're really an expert on. And often some of those collections make their way to us. Yes, some games are hard to find, especially important games, like games that played a part in a key moment in the development of games. But and a new problem too with video games especially is that some of them are born digital and are never anything more than an online game. That is a whole new field of study, how to save those and preserve them. And we have experts at the museum who are working on that all the time. We're not the only people. Many people are concerned with, you know, what happens when a game is only exists online and then it ends. How do you record that? And it's, of course, it's basically data, which sort of has to be stored, but kind of continuously renewed. So there are firms that specialize in that as well.
Well, you're an analog guy, and this is your great passion. I think the museum doubled its footprint just in recent years. What brought you there in 1998, and where was it at in 1998?
It was still a history museum in those days. It was exploring sort of history and culture in America, sort of in the Northeast area where we are. We did some innovative shows, and we published too. We sort of had a great museum, but people didn't come. As we were sort of a Victorian museum, if you can imagine that. We're now on our third building expansion. Our exhibit space right now is about 100,000 square feet. We're almost doubling that, and it's still in the process of being built. It's scheduled to open in 2023.
The very beginning was, as I mentioned, Margaret Woodbury Strong. And this is going way back now. But this is what gives us the start of the story. It's quite sad, yes, Reading parts of her story, but part of her personality and perhaps part of her life experience was that she was a prolific collector of the everyday, as you mentioned, dolls and toys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and she had the wealth to do that. Her father had invested very early in a young man named George Eastman. And in the city of Rochester, our largest business for a long time, not anymore, was Eastman Kodak. So they were the single largest investor in Eastman Kodak, and the family policy was never to sell any stock. Margaret married and had one child, but she outlived both her child and her husband. And I think some of her frustration of losing, you know, her own family led her to collect things almost fanatically. She was a competitive collector. She had also excelled in a lot of different projects during her life, sports. She loved golf. In fact, took golf lessons from one of the American golf pros early on. But she did love toys. She loved anything in miniature. And I think she got that from her parents, who, when they would visit a country in Europe, or they went to Japan a lot, they'd give her a shopping bag and said, you can buy as much as you want, just fill the bag. Don't buy any more. So she learned that if she bought tiny things, she could get more of them.
And so a lot of this was miniature. I think in the 60s, 1969, the museum opens and you've got this array. But as you mentioned, in the mid-1990s, there was a strategic rethink. Margaret Strong gone now, and the museum perhaps not getting people through the door. And so it refocuses what it does. Your specialty, paper artifacts and board games. So where did you begin with bringing your expertise to this refocused museum?
Well, I was more of an expert on paper at first, and went to graduate school. And so paper, board games and card games are paper-based. So it was kind of a natural fit when that job opened up in 1998 that I should take over the board games. And of course, like many people. I certainly grew up playing them and still do. I'm fascinated by the design, both the design of how you play it, but also sort of 19th century games had such decorative covers. And, you know, people didn't have large images then. If you bought a game, a fancy game in 1890, that might be your single holiday present. So they sort of cherished these things. They're really beautiful. They tend to be made of wood covered with paper and cardboard covered with this sort of decorative chromolithographed paper that it's very rich. It's very hard to duplicate now.
When did board games start to become part of household life, however? You mentioned you might have got one early on and that was it forever for the household. When did they become as ubiquitous as they did over the 20th century?
Again, in the late 19th century is sort of known as the golden age of board games among collectors, just because these major companies in America, it was the Parker Brothers out of Salem, Massachusetts, and Milton Bradley, Springfield, Massachusetts, both New England. Those two companies sort of had different philosophies about gaming, but they both created these beautiful early games, like I was talking about. They tended to have wooden pawns that had been turned on a lathe, so they were, you know, very detailed and beautiful game board pathways, that kind of thing.
Let's look at some of them that have really lasted the distance. What are some of the board games that stay with you as having tremendous longevity?
Well, of course, we have to mention Monopoly, which is popular around the world now. And it helped the Parker Brothers company get through the Great Depression because it was so popular in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s, it just kept growing. And at the Strong, we have Charles Darrow's prototype Monopoly, which is round instead of square, the board. So that's really one of our museum treasures. But we also have the precursor to Monopoly, which was invented by a woman, Elizabeth Maggie, who created the Landlord's Game, and we have a copy of that as well. And it's basically, if you look at it, it's got four railroads. It's all about buying real estate. It is Monopoly with different place names and such. But her game wasn't that popular. A lot of schools started using it as a teaching tool, and that's basically, there were two ways to play it. You could just play it for a few rounds, or you could play it to the bitter end and one player would have a monopoly and the other players would go bankrupt. That was the fun way to play it. So they started calling it the Monopoly version or the Monopoly game. And Charles Darrow played that, a handmade version, which people made their own because there just weren't that many around. And he said, you know, I could make a version of this and market it. And he did that in like 1934. 1935 was, I think, the first year that Monopoly started selling.
Interesting. It was in a time of depression, and maybe it was just a dream for people to play. Don't know how popular it would be in some places at the moment, because unfortunately it's become real life for too many people in too many societies, including the housing crisis we're having here in New Zealand.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. But you can imagine at the time when it was just dreaming and playing at dreaming of a better life. And so it becomes very popular.
Well, you know, the Great Depression was a time when games were really popular. Jigsaw puzzles were the most popular that they've ever been in 1933. Card games like Bridge really grew. It was born in the 20s, but the 30s were its biggest year. You know, people didn't have a lot of cash to go out, do things outside, so they stayed with their family and played board games and assembled puzzles.
The jigsaw puzzle, what is its provenance? Because it's a piece of genius. And where can we begin the story?
Well, we have the world's oldest jigsaw puzzle. I believe the date is 1670. Jigsaw puzzles grew out of maps. Map makers, we're not really sure who started it, but we believe we have the oldest one, a map maker in England, which is where board games essentially were born, decided to cut up a map along the lines of country borders. And this became a toy for royalty to learn their geography, which of course was very important to them. You need to learn about the country and what borders it if you're going to be the ruler someday. So we know that George III, as a boy, assembled puzzles, and some of those puzzles are actually in America at Princeton University. They have a small collection of puzzles that were owned by George III.
And the particular genius of them is the way bits fit together. Was that a breakthrough when the right kind of material could be used, the right cutting mechanisms could be used to really make them work without having to bang your hand on them, bang your fist on them for ages?
Well, of course, the first ones were wood. And if you've ever assembled a wooden puzzle, it's really satisfying to sort of snap the pieces into place. Many cardboard puzzle makers, even to this day, will try to make thicker puzzles to sort of give it a little bit more of that textural feeling. But puzzles, especially during the recent pandemic, enjoyed another big wave of popularity, at least here in the States.
Yes, they need to be thick enough to be satisfying, to realise you've got the right piece and to click it in. It is very much a physical act. On the question of some of the other games, we spotted your name and therefore your museum when we were reading about Cluedo recently and the apparent sort of castle or mansion that was the inspiration for it in England, I think, has been sold back to Monopoly. Anyway, it has become, for such a simple game in many ways, on a topic, you know, whodunit, Agatha Christie-style topic that's been around forever, it's become a real stayer. What is the story of Cluedo?
Cluedo, we call it Clue here in the States, is also already an inductee in our National Toy Hall of Fame, which is toys and games and dolls. I believe it was again in the 30s that a gentleman in England, he had been, there was a fad, I think, in the late 20s, and he had, I believe, worked in some kind of a small hotel, like a boutique hotel, and they would host these fanciful murder parties, you know, as a game for guests. And so he learned about that then. Well, then, of course, during the Great Depression, he was thinking about how to invent a game. And he thought, well, why not? You know, that was so much fun. Let's make this into a game. So he did. And there's a legend, I don't know if it's true, that people were playing Cluedo as they sat in the underground train stations during World War II.
And are the characters that we learn to love so much, are they universal? You know, Miss Scarlet in the library with a candlestick or whatever, and Colonel Mustard? Mrs. Peacock, I forgot
yes.
about Mrs. Peacock.
Yes, although there are vanity versions of The Simpsons, Cluedo, for example, they make, but yes, those are classic characters. Recently, they have added some more ethnic ones to sort of balance it out, which I think is a good thing. But yes, those standard characters are still there.
It's very much like Agatha Christie, really, except the players can fill the gaps. And is that simplicity and agency in many ways the secret to it?
Yes. And it appeals to young and old. That's another great thing that a game should do, because some games aren't appropriate for both ages to play at once, but Cluedo really is.
It has been adapted too, and I love the way this has happened. For example, if you're a fan of the Alfred Hitchcock films, I think about 1999, you could play Miss Scarlet as Melanie Daniels from The Birds, which I still remember. There's also Frenzy, there's a Bates Motel scene from Psycho. So the basic premise has been adapted to whatever your popular culture favours.
Yes, absolutely.
What is
It's
the.
funny. I think
Yeah,
I
tell
always
me.
think of Agatha Christie, and I also do think of Hitchcock when I
Yes.
play Clue.
What happens with the licensing of games? Because this is, as you've alluded to earlier with Monopoly, this is big business. And have we seen
Yes.
some stories of licensing rights and power plays that could almost become a game themselves?
It's really all about that. It feels like nowadays, more monopolies now are licensed versions, whether it's for a sports team. There's New York Yankees Monopoly. There's Boston Red Sox Monopoly. It's the same is true for other games. I know there's the game Jenga, which was also invented in England very recently, and which just got into the National Toy Hall of Fame last year. We have New York Yankee Jenga and Boston Red Sox Jenga. They're rivals, so it's fun to put them together. And with Star Wars now being owned by Disney, there certainly are multiple Star Wars Monopoly versions and other games, every other game. And so that would be licensing through Disney now, which I'm sure is pretty complicated. But classic games continue to be made. And now those licensed games are, I think, more common than just a standard game.
Nicholas Ricketts is our guest. He's the curator of the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. He's been in that role since 1998. His particular skill set is paper artifacts and board games. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National, 26 minutes to 11. You mentioned Jenga being more contemporary. Now, this was interesting. This was, I think, an English national, but who had been living in what's now the Republic of Tanzania in East Africa. And this was the origin for the game she eventually developed, and that's become a big commercial hit.
Yes, that's true. She's lovely. I've met her.
Leslie
She
Scott.
played a game that was similar. Leslie Scott is her name. She played a game that was similar as a child, and her family owned a sawmill. So I think she could gather scraps from that and sort of thought, I'm going to make my own version of this. And she did, and the family liked it, and friends liked it. So when she eventually moved back to England, I think, as about an 18-year-old, she brought some of those games with her, took them to parties, and people loved them. So that's sort of how Jenga got its start, and it is has not stopped. It is everywhere.
Another quite unique game that on the face of it is simple but becomes much more is Scrabble, which I think again dates back to Depression era, just pre-World War II era. How
Yes.
did it begin its life?
It was another gentleman who I believe was unemployed during the Depression. And he just decided he'd invent a board game. But he went about it very scientifically. He wanted to pick the most sort of popular letters, but he went about it in a scientific way. And trial and error, I finally came up with a sort of prototype for Scrabble, crisscross words, he called it. People played it and liked it. And another man who was more of a marketer purchased it from him, although he would get royalties for the rest of his life. And this man marketed it. And it took a while. It was really not until the 50s that Scrabble really took off. I think 1953 was the year that, I don't know, everybody wanted to play Scrabble. You see it turning up in advertising for anything. You know, an automobile car would have a Scrabble tiles spelling out the name of the car in an advertisement. So, yeah, Scrabble is another one of those sort of, I want to build a game and I want it to be perfect. And I like word games, so let's do it.
Word games, but with a physical touch again. You can line up your little board with your little squares on them. It brings to mind perhaps what some of the facets of a good game is: your independent contribution, a good competition, scrapping over the rules. It's like cards, isn't it? Because it requires an individual focus and sense of reward, but we're doing it together. That's the point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the social aspect of both card games and board games, what we call table games, is very important, and especially important for children. Another classic game that we have here is Candyland. And it's simple, and parents hate playing it, but it's really good for kids because they recognize their colors, they learn to count, and they learn to socialize.
Not quite a board game, but it was huge in its day, and I think it might be on its way back, is Dungeons and Dragons. What is its story?
Oh, absolutely. Dungeons and Dragons grew out of sort of a tradition of wargaming that began in the 1970s here in America. And it was taken up by the Germans, too. And it's that kind of grew into the kind of games like Settlers of Catan that are around today. But Dungeons and Dragons was based on war games, except they added this fantasy element to it. You are pretending that you're marching into a dungeon, and someone is guiding you. That is the sort of leader of your gaming group. And it's based on a lot of different ways of changing the outcomes. But it's also, you're fantasizing that you are an elf, you know, going through this dungeon. Anyway, it was completely innovative at the time. That was 1973, I believe. And the company that made it thought, oh, you know, this is fun. We like it. I wonder how many will sell. Well, they sold out almost immediately just from word of mouth. It became really big on college campuses, I think. And then gradually, high school, middle school, younger and younger people played it. And now they make similar games where you take on a role, much simpler, even for young children.
Finally, just some of the stories behind how you've come across some of these acquisitions. You mentioned sometimes your name, your reputation is built, and you'll get a whole collection. What are some of the ones that really came to mind where you just had to pinch yourself?
Oh, well, I really love handmade games, and some of those are just wonderful. We have a handmade Monopoly from, I think, the 40s, the 1940s. And a woman just phoned me and said, my father made this game when he was a little boy, and he made it to entertain his younger sister. So it's place names from where they lived, which I believe was in the state of Michigan here in the States. But the chance and community chess cards are all very, very funny. And even the property names are silly, you know, property names based on their neighborhood. So, and everything is just made by hand, you know, written out longhand on little cards. And then the board itself is made that way too. So, and, you know, she was glad to have it find a permanent home in the museum, and of course where it'll be cared for. So that's one good story.
Who was Don Lyon who brought you, I think, a whole collection from 1950 to about 2000? That's like winning the lottery.
Yeah, he was a collector. I think local, or at least in New York State. He contacted me He had a son who was physically disabled, and to find something that they could do together, the father would take him, and they would go to what we call garage sales here and household sales, and buy used games and then play them. And it was a vast range of old and new, simple and complicated, and even some really rare ones, because I think that was part of the play for them, was finding a nice rare game. And then his son got older, and he still had the collection of games, so he contacted the museum and donated it. Yeah, that was great.
Two great family stories, aren't they? A brother looking after his sister, putting his time into making something fun for his sister, and then also in your second story, how games can connect people. There's another classic, I think, that you must be very happy with. Was it Blade Runner, where you got a rare example before there became a legal issue and it was pulled from the shelves? What was that story about?
That actually came from that same collection from Mr. Lion. Yeah, that happens sometimes. Blade Runner was a really popular film, and someone with the capacity to make board games made a game really quickly without even thinking about licensing or copyright rules or anything like that. And Blade Runner continued to be a popular film, and people have lawyers who look out for that kind of thing, because people do break those rules. And so those games were pulled from the shelf, and I'm sure later on an officially licensed version was done, but that makes a game really rare if they stopped producing it and it was taken from store shelves, but a few are out there. And so, yeah, we got that great game.
Wonderful stuff. Enjoy. It sounds like there's a period of really extraordinary growth happening, and it's incorporating all of the games post the analog era as well. Thank you for sharing it all with us, Nicholas.
It's my pleasure.
Nicholas Ricketts is the curator of the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York.